it's my pleasure. This is the Seymour Comparative Effectiveness Research Series, in case you didn't know that. And I have the honor of introducing Ken, who really doesn't need introductions to anyone here, but I'm going to let you hear it all again. You know, he's partly UCLA molded, but he did his MD degree at San Francisco. The competition, UCSF. He is got a ton of responsibilities here. Senior scientist at RAND, professor of psychiatry and biobehavioral sciences in our school, professor of health sciences at the School of Public Health, directs the Health Services Research Center at the Semmel Institute, I don't know if I can read this whole thing in the time that we have.
Don't worry about it.
Here we go. Co-director of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation Clinical Scholars Program, and by the way, anyone who was at their dinner last year when the faculty was parodied, he's the only one that was really compassionately parodied there.
I wasn't at that dinner.
I think it's taped, and I think you would enjoy it. But they did a great job. The first recipient of the Young Investigator Award and Distinguished Investigator Award of the Academy Health, the American Psychiatric Association Award for Research. And his current research interests, if this is up to date, is what he's going to be talking about today, community-based participatory research, excuse me, and CER in that context for mental health services in and community partnerships in this interaction. Ken has told me that this is going to be a trio, what we hear today, and so thanks for coming, and we're delighted that you came and contributed to the seminar. You know it is being recorded.
You're right.
Yes.
Great. Well, thanks for showing up, and I hope we can make this interactive. So let me introduce my two community partners who are working with me on this project and many other things, and also quite involved in the Clinical Scholars Program. Jim Gilmore, who's from Behavioral Health Services, he's actually the chair of the community consortium for the Clinical Scholars Program, and Felica Jones, who is research director, or
the program
director at Healthy African American Families. And the three of us have been working along with about 40 leaders in Los Angeles and maybe 15 academic partners on this big project that we're going to be talking to you about. And I thought, it is a comparative effectiveness study, and I think and a rigorous one, but it's also rigorous in that it is completely community partnered in all of its respects. So I thought it might be interesting to talk some about how that's going, what the partnership is doing to the research and vice versa, what the research is doing to the community, what we're learning together, and some early results, because we've just finished all of our subject recruitment in this large study. So it's called Community Partners in Care, which is designed to try to improve depression, figure out how to best implement collaborative care for depression in underserved communities of color, especially in Los Angeles. So the very brief background, this is a marriage of two kind of streams of thought. One is the partnered research model, and those of you involved in Export and RICMAR and the Scholars Program, various centers that have been exploring this model, don't need an introduction to that. But Felica is going to help us a bit think about what community partnered and community research and community engagement is.
Hi, everyone. Good afternoon. Happy New Year to everyone.
Thank you.
So in our partnership, the circle of influence was developed by the community and academic partners to look at the stream of how information and the development of everything is going to flow. And so the circle of influence, as you can see on the outer rim, is the community as a whole. And the community is defined of anybody that has a vested interest in the community, as well as lay community members that are partnerships in this in the project. And then our resident experts are the, you know, people that know the community best. And that doesn't necessarily mean the residents of that community, but people that, you know, community-based organizations, faith-based community. It could be the nonprofits that are working in within that community, or just businesses that are in that community that have a vested interest in outcomes. And then the way that our circle evolves is the partnership is a free-flowing from both ends. It's not just directed in or directed out from our academic partners, but it's actually a free-flowing mechanism that goes back and forth from both as an equal partnership, which is a little bit different from the model that we normally use, is where the academic comes into the community and has kind of an outline plan and then asks community, what do you think about this plan, and then get feedback. This model is intended to make sure that community has a development from the very beginning to the very end. And it's a partnership, so it's equal partnership between the academic partner as well as the community partner, and the free-flowing sharing of information, the responsibility and authority of every document, including IRB issues and development of the plan, and everything that has to do with it, the goal setting, how we set each goal and discuss the objectives, outcomes that's going to come from it, and the planning process. So the planning process that we've had from the very beginning was we got to the table, we had a conference, talked about what it was that we would like to address, and then moved it forward from that point, and then evolved from that level. And if you wanted to add anything to that.
So if you think of that as a, you know, kind of a large framework for the interaction and structuring the work within an interaction, then the question is literally, how do you set up a project that can function in that way? Mm-hmm. And because every project needs a management structure and a task structure and that sort of thing. So this model and framework has a core set of principles that Felica referred to, for example, the two-way equal power sharing. It's not necessarily everyone's doing the same thing, but there's an agreement over who's doing what, and it's going both ways, not just academic down to community, if you will, or the other way around. Mm-hmm. And that requires finding the common ground between different stakeholder perspectives. Another core principle is doing this in such a way that supports the community's capacity. So, for example, doing an intervention, you know, you might say to learn about that intervention that might be subsequently applied in the community doesn't necessarily build that community's capacity right now. There might be other ways of doing that developmental step that, in fact, do build capacity. Whether it's the ability of the community to know how to develop interventions, for example, so more active involvement of the community in that process, you know, gives them some tools to bring to some other problem of their interest as well. So that is another core principle. The structure, again, to facilitate that, and then I'll let Jim and Felica elaborate, is we have a council that is partnered, that's equally co-led by community and academic leaders. There's a broader set of community fora and multiple opportunities to check back in. So even the council really doesn't have the authority to design and implement a project without at major points touching in with the community and saying, okay, this is what we're thinking of doing, what do you think? Do you agree? How should we modify that? So the community is community representatives beyond the council are key. And then there are partnered work groups, which may involve people from the council. It may involve people from these broader community groups that have come together to give input. Or other kinds of experts that are needed on a particular problem, let's say design, measures, and so forth. So all components of the project, all, are structured around partnered work groups. And those groups are developing action plans for approval implementing and evaluating approved plans and disseminating what their scope is and their findings back to the study, back to the community, for the scientific literature, and so on. So that's a structure that the entire project becomes embedded in.
And I just would like to add one piece to, you know, when we say it's finding a win-win for the community academic, is a lot of community-based organizations participate in research and they never, you know, hear back, or the community as a whole. But one of the best parts of our project that we found as working with the community agencies, they get to learn really what does an IRB mean. They get to learn the importance of research in terms of developing their program to withstand over time, to build out. So they get a tangible win-win out of the project, and they've learned and they've been published in certain academic arenas and presented as places like APHA, community members, which has been a big win-win for them and for the academic partners. On the other end is to really get the feedback that that they need, you know, to really move the research in a way that is comprehensive and building for the community and the research and materials that we're trying to develop in the beginning.
I think a really important part of it also was we have the principles and the structure, but that really needs to be understood by the core group. And I think we spent a lot of time making sure that everybody understood what it was, because folks came into the process with preconceived ideas of academia and research projects. This all was coming together at a time when other services were, you know, because of funding and other issues, other services were being, you know, they were decreasing or disappearing, which also goes to the community support capacity, because here we have this great concept and people coming together with this idea at the same time they're losing staff right and left and losing contracts right and left. So it was really important that folks not look at this as just a research, but a part of a project that they were part of and they had say in how it worked. Going back to what Felica was saying, is that not that, you know, this group of academicians was going to come in and take away a bunch of stuff and then see you, thanks. But to actually involve them in the process. And I think that there was some hope that by coming together in this particular project, it would be kind of a lesson for them in coming together in other issues that the community has to face and deal with.
The other aspect of the structure, just to touch base on, because we'll be following it to some extent in this presentation, is we think of this model as progressing in stages. Mm-hmm. So the first stage is the vision stage or the planning stage, where goals, relationship building, and so forth occurs. The second is the valley, or the, you know, the tough work of getting things done that people agree to do, and then the victory is celebration. Over the years, as I've apprenticed myself in this model with community partners like Felica and Jim, what I've learned is that it's helpful to think of almost any aspect of the work as having those three phases. So if a partner group is working on a set of measures, there's also planning, work, and a little victory celebration. So there's a sense of accomplishment that's acknowledged and recognized. We're not very good at that in academics, really, right? It's just next task. Next, as my wife says, next more. You know, it's like... So taking that time to acknowledge and recognize, give back, celebrate, and appreciate accomplishments, even in small ways. Otherwise, it's, as Jim said, in the context of how stressed the communities are, it's just not worth it. Why show up? You know, what, to be given five more tasks? You know, I mean, you can at least, you know, get lunch and be thanked for what was just done. And so this is, again, kind of a heuristic or a paradigm for thinking of how work is accomplished and produced in such a project.
So is your idea that the victory is translates to the disseminate? So that's where you're
on the larger sense of the word. So when you see the design of this project, what you'll see is there's a big planning phase. There's a trial that's embedded within this project, which is what you would normally think of as the comparative effectiveness study. That's the valley in the larger sense. And then there's a whole phase of this project that is the dissemination phase. But even, you know, as I mentioned, in smaller subtasks of the project, each of them is approached with this mindset. And we've given some references there. Okay, and then just a little bit of background before we go into the trial, it's the actual project itself. So, as many of you know, I've worked on depression for many years, the medical outcome study, the partners in care study, and some other projects. And it's a nice tracer condition for looking at the performance of the healthcare system because it's still somewhat unrecognized, you might say, at the patient and even the provider level, leading cause of disability in the world. So it's a big problem that people can relate to, but it's kind of undercover a little bit still. And there are plenty of evidence-based treatments that work that tend to be underutilized. Both primary and specialty care are major care settings for depression, and there's a larger gap in quality of care, recognition, and provision of treatment in primary care. But the reason we're doing this project is what we've learned, especially in underserved communities, is that so many other agencies at the table are dealing with clients who are depressed within their scope, whether it's a community outreach and advocacy agency, or whether it's a substance abuse agency, which is behavioral health services scope. They're trying to deal with this problem too. So it's much larger than a traditional healthcare setting problem. So the kind of, I'm sure you're, almost all of you are familiar with collaborative care for chronic disease management. It's the traditional framework. It's a multi-component systems-based approach to intervention in chronic disease that includes case management, proactive screening, activating patients, in the case of depression, cognitive behavioral therapy or some other form of active therapy. There are a number of problem-solving, interpersonal psychotherapy for depression. Psychotropic medication management is often a big part of depression management. Team-based quality review, provider education and support, and then system changes. And they may be improving information systems or changing clinic hours so that actually people can go there when the counseling is being offered, increasing the cultural diversity of providers available so that people feel more comfortable. Those are all system changes that may be done. And there have been a number of reviews of the evidence-based literature around collaborative care for depression. And this JAMA article that I've cited reviewed 27 trials. There's unequivocal, overwhelming evidence for effectiveness, most likely cost effectiveness. Only a few of the studies have done that. And this review, looking at what was more or less strongly implemented in different studies, ended up feeling that care management, case management, care management was sort of a particularly essential ingredient. Not sufficient, but necessary. So we did a large collaborative care study, more traditionally focused. It was a national study in multiple managed care community-based sites called Partners in Care. And we introduced patients for 6 to 12 months within their practices to enriched opportunities to consider evidence-based treatment under a collaborative care model. They weren't assigned a treatment. They were in practices that had been supported to improve their capacities to provide medication management or psychotherapy under their own steam with our support. And what we found, we actually had from that 6 to 12 months of supporting practices, we had improved patient outcomes through 10 years. So we've recently published 10-year follow-up. But this is 5 years, just using this as an example. So what we found is that African Americans leapt forward in their care. You can see the intervention groups combined in green. Latinos gained quite a bit more. This is in terms of recovery from depression at the end of 5 years, or still being depressed at that point. And whites got somewhat better, but basically they managed to find ways of getting better over time anyway, that more opportunities in their environment, in their practices and so forth, in the long run. Everyone gained in the first 2 years. And the benefits extended beyond health to employment. There was a 7% greater employment rate in people in the collaborative care groups over the first 2 years, as well as family wealth. So that's that, plus these disparity findings, is why about 7 years ago I approached Healthy African American Families and started trying to figure out what does it mean to bring this kind of approach into underserved communities of color. If you've got overcoming disparities, big outcome improvement in African Americans, and effects on employment and wealth, this seems like kind of a big story in the community, potentially. So we did a, we got engaged. At this point, I usually present an engagement ring to my community partners, but I don't want to freak Jim out. And we did a 4-year exploration in a project called Witness for Wellness, which we won't go through, about sort of how to do this. Depression, unlike, let's say, diabetes, is a highly stigmatized condition. Don't tell me I'm crazy, is what you hear. I'm not depressed. So the engagement with the community has special challenges with mental health conditions like depression, which again makes it a good test case for how could you really do this. If you're going to be facing those kind of challenges for depression, it should be a little easier maybe for heart disease or arthritis. During that phase, what I learned to do is to listen, share power, respect differences, develop and honor agreements. This is what I learned from apprenticing myself. Embracing the community, not as the subject of a study, but as a partner. And to find ways of honoring community strength in a asset-promoting, strength-based approach while building community capacity and not just worrying about the results. The result, in other words, including those outcomes as results that were equally important.
And I just want to add on one point on that, in getting engaged into a marriage, and many of you are married or in a committed relationship, is that there always are these ups and downs in the marriage. And that's one of the things, the beautiful part about our partnership, is because when we respect the differences and we listen and we share, we learn a lot from one another, and we can stay committed to the goal of what we came to the table for. And that's a big piece that I think that as, and Jim can jump in on this, is that we really, the community and the academic partners, have been committed, even in the rough times of disagreement or not fully coming on board to where we are at that point, and worked it out over time so that we, and I think the community as a whole has valued that the researchers and academicians that have been at the table have continued to, you know, because sometimes the meetings are not that productive or nice. But the respect that happens at the table and the commitment that happens for the relationship that we have has really proven to be an optimal piece for this project.
Michael, do you want to come and join us? Michael is one of the main investigators in this project.
I'm happy to sit in the back of that room, really.
Okay, all right. Well, please feel free to chime in.
But you're part of the engagement.
Yes.
And I wanted to point out, you know, that usually comes after the marriage, what you're talking about. Yeah. So you went from engaged to married here, right?
Okay.
Well, we worked through that.
Yeah,
I think early on, I learned that tension and conflict are an essential part of this work, and that to think otherwise is just a terrible mistake. You basically can't do the work if you're not aware that there are going to be disagreements, and there have to be disagreements to bridge these differences, and that's within the community as well as between academic and community sectors. So anyway, those lessons went into some articles that I've listed there and that are posted on communitytrials.org.
Right.
And then from there, we were fortunate enough to get funding to do this crazy large study. Jim, do you want to help us get into
Well, yeah, I think you kind of set the groundwork for where the concept came from. Folks coming together in a collaborative process. And this was really, to a lot of people, it was a whole new concept. Again, as I said before, people had preconceived notions of academia, of research, of on both sides. I shouldn't just say that, but some of the academicians had concepts about the community and, oh, well, they don't really want to participate and, you know, they don't know what we were talking about. And a lot of times that was true. We spent a lot of time translating academic language so that everybody could understand and appreciate. But I think Ken and the steering committee did a great job of bringing out what it was we were trying to accomplish in the sense of depression. Because in the communities we were working with, for a lot of people, depression is a way of life. So setting that out as, well, this is a disorder that you have and it needs to be addressed, or going, well, how about give me a job? How about putting a grocery store in my neighborhood? How about doing a lot of these things and maybe I won't feel this way? But the concept of depression as a clinical condition was kind of new to folks because it's not what they look at. And, you know, in terms of resources in the community, there weren't a lot of resources for folks who could identify a mental health condition. There still wasn't necessarily the kinds of services that they need in the community that they could access. So, as I say, I think the project did a great job of kind of convincing people, you know, what it was we're dealing with and how we wanted to go about it and how they could participate in that. Rather than, you know, we're going to come in and look at all you depressed people, it's kind of like, let's all get together and see what we can do about depression in the community. People thought, that's interesting. So they did start coming together, and I think that, you know, this discussion about the relationship part was just part of that. I mean, folks, you know, still kind of came in with what's in it for me, what do you want from me, what's going on. So there was a lot of time just kind of getting to know each other, building the communication, which I think, again, everybody knows that's the major, you know, consideration in any kind of a relationship is being able to communicate with each other. So, you know, we spent a lot of time doing that. And then we kind of went into, and again, the steering committee and the academicians and Ken kind of had an idea where they wanted to go with this. But it is a partnership. So it's kind of like throwing that out and then saying, what do you think, how do you want to be involved in that? So that was a really interesting part of all of this, is folks actually getting to be, being able to be a part of the planning process, being able to say, well, this is what we need in our community, not what you think we need, but this is what we think we need, and how do we work on that together? So, you know, the framework, which I think is the next slide, kind of shows, you know, how we wanted to bring this process together. So the community capacity is something we had to look at, the academic capacity, and then the partnered planning vision. This is where academicians, community partner providers, and the members of the community itself kind of came together to plan what do we want to do, how are we going to do this, and then the trial, the valley, it's kind of like what resources are available, the whole community engagement and planning. Each member of the community kind of had its own constituency, you might say, that a group of people that they were kind of connected to. So we had to figure out how we can get the same message out to everybody and still get people involved in being a part of this.
So the trial phase, which is the comparative effectiveness piece, was designed and as you'll see when we get to the next set of slides, we're going to show you how the community revised the design in this engagement process. The whole proposal was developed with extensive community input, but that's different than this layered process of community input at the detailed level during the actual detailed preparation of the design once it's funded. So what it was designed to do was to compare two models, one that we ended up calling resources for services, and that was support for individual agencies to take the existing model from Partners in Care of collaborative care for depression and do what they could and wanted to do and felt was appropriate to the scope of their agency with that model. That was the control condition. Talk about a demanding control condition. So it was basically to do some kind of orientation and support to implement some components of collaborative care. But as you'll see, these are not just primary care or mental health specialty practices. It's basically a whole range of community practices. And the community input broadened it even beyond, you know, sort of the wildest dreams that I had going into the project. The active condition, or the one that we were particularly interested in looking at in comparison to what you might say a standard disease management company would do, that's resources for services, was community engagement and planning. The idea is, can we take this community-partnered participatory research model and make that the engine through which thinking about implementation of collaborative care in the community is redesigned? So doing what we would do as a council, bringing the community agencies together assigned to that condition, working collaboratively in planning, retooling collaborative care for their specific community and population. For example, the idea was deciding, well, look, if you do medication management, I'll do case management and we'll share, and you know, we can have some agreements about how we'll share clients. I mean, many of those ideas turned out to be quite foolish, but that was the idea, that this a CPPR-based implementation, community implementation, versus agency-specific technical assistance for implementing collaborative care, as a way of asking whether community engagement matters for bringing evidence-based care to the community over and above, you know, basically technical assistance. So that is the design of the study. And then looking at a variety of outcomes at the client level, at the agency level, at the provider level, for what gets changed and transformed. So it's a three-stakeholder level outcome study of these two models. The models are randomized at the program level. When I say program, it would be like GIM is a program of the medical school or something like that. So, or you follow me, or so it's not the whole agency, it's a program. The outpatient program of a behavioral health site would be a program. So a program with all of its providers and clients gets randomized to one of these two models.
Ken, I think it's worth mentioning too, and I don't know if you're going to do it later on, but the partners themselves were not necessarily all mental health providers. This included everyone from owners of Curves, an exercise program, barbershops, senior citizens, the park system. So it's trusted sites, but it's folks who deal with these folks at a number of different levels that they would enter into this process. About half really are able to provide, you know, mental health services, but there's a lot of other services involved that these other folks provide. So that was, I think, a really important part of the whole collaboration, was it wasn't just restricted to one group of people.
But how that happened, and that and this is on a later slide, but let's talk about it now since we're there. It's okay. No. How that happened is we proposed to include mental health sites, primary care sites, and social services. Then when we did this stage that we're talking about of having the broader community input, you know, kind of presenting this is what we're planning, we asked them, I remember we had a dinner, we had about 70 community members, they broke into tables, and we asked them to problem solve on where in the community they would like to see services. And they ended up nominating a whole, you know, much broader a range of services than we had been prepared for, and quite adamantly.
Well, to address the issue of how do we beat depression in the community, was that, you know, the idea was that if I'm a WorkSource investment program and I'm trying to get people back to work and go to training, but yet they're not following up with the work plan, is because maybe they may be depressed. So that agency was interested because I need to know how to address depression to get my people to work so I can fulfill my contracts. So it was other different ideas. So that's why when the community came to him, says, we need to start looking at some of the other sites of vested agencies in the community that don't necessarily look at depression care, don't screen for depression, don't look at these kinds of conditions, but it does affect their way of the way they're doing their business. So it was like those, so we brought those people to the table and they were very much interested in, so they can't provide depression care services directly, but they can then make sure that their clients or their participants are able to receive some type of screening or looking at some kind of way of addressing that they may be depressed. So that was one of their reasons for wanting to be there at the table as well.
Yeah. So let's, most of you in the room would be, are in the position of designing studies, let's look at some of the, I mentioned the CPPR structure. So we have a partnered council that's at the top. We're three of those members responsible for all major decisions. There is an executive committee within that council to expedite. Really, the executive committee doesn't have greater authority. It's given authority by the council because not everyone can convene as often as the executive committee can. We're three members of the executive committee. And we sort of have some rules of thumb. If at least three, at least two community and two academic agree, within 24 hours, move forward. Unless it's particularly sensitive issue for a partner, like if it's about substance abuse, Jim has to weigh in. So I have to track him down. And then we have these partnered committees. I mentioned that all the committees are partnered. Partnered design, measurement, intervention development, study and intervention, implementation evaluation, operations and recruitment, dissemination and products. So those are the major design committees, each of which has got one or two community and academic co-leads that chair those meetings together. The intervention structure, each different intervention, there are two CEP Council. CEP is Community Engagement and Planning, the active kind of community engagement intervention. There's one of those for each SPA. In this study, there are two communities, two large community clusters, South LA and Hollywood Metro Downtown with a little touch of Boyle Heights in it. So those long stretches of multiple communities each have a replication going on of the study. So but the resources for services, since that's a standard cookbook approach to technical assistance, is one intervention group across the whole study. That also had expert community engagement specialist as a consultant to that committee, because you just can't do anything really in the community and expect uptake without community engagement. So, and then we have the community forums. I mentioned that. We have a policy advisory board, which met in the middle of the first year and had an enormous effect on slowing down the study and telling me to shut up. that was their major intervention. Stop thinking you're running this project. Get out of the way of this project. And then we have a national scientific and policy advisors and funders. And we always in this model have the funders as part of the council. And if we get more funders, they add and join the council. It's all part of what allows the project to have power, in the world.
How big is the council, Ken? And how big is the executive committee?
The executive committee has about eight people on it. The council has about 30. There is turnover. Sort of each major phase of the study, some agencies have left and come on board. They stay informed. About 12 to 15 are at any particular meeting. Okay. making sure it's not an emergency call from the study.
Can I have a question? How was all of this structure in place when CPIC started, or how much of this was sort of
all this had this, all of this was developed during the planning year.
Oh, okay.
And still it's going through an evolution.
Got it.
Okay, so now we're going to touch upon, in the interest of time, I think what we should do is pull out some examples from these next sets of slides. We can't go through all these examples. So Tom Bellin, who's our statistician for this project, and by the way, he really understands community engagement from a design perspective, and was extremely helpful in doing things like this. When we came to defining the scope of communities, Tom said there are so many things that, you know, technical people in the study are going to have to decide, give anything to the community to decide with minimal input from us that we possibly can. And the first of those were what are the boundaries of the communities? You know, Tom said, I don't want to be involved in that role. That's going to be Felica and Jim and Loretta, and they are going to define these boundaries for us. And so they took over that in total. The agencies, Jim and Felica have already talked some about what happened. So we went in with a proposed set, and in the community meeting, it was completely redefined to community trusted locations, parks and recreation, senior centers, faith-based, local businesses, public health sites, other things that were not in the design at all. Providers, similarly, in that same meeting, were redefined from service providers and caseworkers to including anyone with client contact. So, for example, a Parks and Recreation program director became a provider. They're not a provider, but they are a potential provider in the study. A receptionist, if they sit down with a patient and help them fill out their intake, they could be a provider. So the scope of thinking about providers greatly expanded. And the most expensive so far, I mean, all of these have costs associated with them. I'm sure those of you used to funding, you know, budgeting studies will understand that, was the last one on this slide. The community, once they understood what this study was about and why we were doing it and what the evidence was behind it, all of that was in these large forums, they said, I want this study to be able to show that our community can accommodate and provide services or have at the table the most vulnerable community members that we have. We want no one left out. So that meant including the homeless, for which the study was not designed, people in prison, on parole, probation, people in HIV programs. So we made a special effort to make sure that a third of the sample was from vulnerable population care settings or community centers serving vulnerable populations. And, you know, as you know, they're much more expensive, typically, to track, to keep engaged in a study, and so on. Also, the interventions got ratcheted up in their intensity, both resources for services, and this was through a year-long process we had of designing interventions, which, you know, the two, you know, let me off. Just mention it, and then maybe the two of you can talk about what that process was like. But the community felt quite uncomfortable with anything approaching care as usual or enhanced care as usual. If we know from the Partners in Care study that these things make such a difference, then we can't do a study where we pretend that we don't know that. So we moved from enhanced usual care to standard implementation, like a disease management company would do, of what's known about collaborative care. That was not what was proposed for the study. So we ratcheted up the control group. Similarly, the community engagement and planning was kind of naively proposed as having a conference and a couple of day training program and several months of supervision. Instead, this became a series of conferences. There have now been something like 20 on-site trainings, webinars, quality review. Also, the council requested having their own budget, independent of something that the overall council would manage. So the intervention councils wanted to say, we need consultants, we need a budget for ourselves. Do you want to talk some about that intervention development process?
Again, it was a small committee's meeting. Issues that came up, we tried to figure ways we could address them. With the resource for services, what we found, because we originally gave everyone a small
USB
disk, power stick, whatever they call them, which had just reams of information on it, but folks had some difficulty navigating and had some difficulty understanding, wanted more, so we moved then into doing some webinars and some training for those folks on what was actually contained in that so they could use it in a better manner. You want to talk about the community planning groups, or?
Why don't we, just in the interest of time, let's, so you've got the general idea. There were major changes to just about everything. I mentioned the policy advisory board. The community leaders nominated the agencies that were going to be included, plus lists. We jointly recruited providers. That was a joint effort. The academic, the RAND survey group, has led and implemented client recruitment, but with extensive community leader training, we actually recruited the survey staff from the community agencies and so on. So it's been a special partnership in almost every activity. And one of the benefits was that the community leaders became very concerned about staff welfare because they were out there in underserved agencies screening for depression. Maybe the first time someone had done that, and you will see how vulnerable this population is when we get to the description of the population. And they were on the front line with people who might be crying or suicidal or whatever. So the community leaders instituted a resiliency program for the survey staff to support their well-being to implement the study. And they ended up doing just a phenomenal implementation job. They expanded the measures. Let's go over that. As you might imagine, the whole idea of a randomized design was a highly sensitive issue in the community. And some of the community partners and Tom constructed a workshop in which we exchanged articles and experiences around trust and scientific equipoise, and had very open discussions of the legacy of Tuskegee, while Tom would then talk about, you know, what is a fair comparison and what does randomization mean. And he developed some really nice strategies, like having the community leaders select the seed numbers to initiate randomization and other things to demystify that process.
So the moral of the story is, we all can do that.
See, we all have something to give. We all have something to contribute to the pot to address depression.
Does anybody have some screening that they can put into the pot?
Come up here and put it in the pot so we have some screening or not.
Come bring it on down.
But this is part of demystifying the intervention and the treatments through a community engagement.
And I believe there's a little bit of patient education out there. Let's get our patients educated. Woo! Starting to smell good, huh? All right, and I think we have some case managers out there. Let's get some case management up here into the pot.
That's right.
I'm starting to drool a little. And I believe we have some outreach. Do we have some outreach workers out there? Woo. We need those, right? And I want the audience to shout out, what are some things that, in your agency, you can contribute? Cultural sensitivity, patience.
There we go. We need some of that inbox.
positivity. We heard positivity. Empathy. Commitment. Authenticity. That will complete our pot.
And everyone. What's the ingredient, Pastor?
Love.
And if you can hold fast to this idea that each of you have something special and distinct to add to a pot that our community needs very dearly, and only you can put it in there. See, the researchers can't do it. We can't do it by ourselves. The preachers can't do it. Our community is suffering from depression, and we all need to be a part of the solution. So I beg of you to stay involved, get involved, be committed, so we can have a healthy stone soup. Thank you.
Now, there's no way that I could have instilled that engagement, right? Very quickly, since we're having to end, some early results. So we, through those kinds of procedures that you just saw, and through the process of this design, we engaged the two communities of serving 2 million people. We ended up recruiting 93 programs in 50 agencies into this randomized trial. And you can see the balance at the bottom between the two intervention conditions. These are the range of agencies. You can sort of see that we have a lot, and they differ by SPA, which is why this needs to be tailored to each community. Lots of substance abuse and social services, because there aren't a lot of formal health care services in South Los Angeles. More health services, public health, primary care, and so forth in Hollywood Metro. In those 93 programs, there 395 providers ended up agreeing to participate in the study, and 277 of them completed the provider baseline survey that Michael has fielded. What you don't know, this is now nested to the 93 main programs. So, and this is who they are. You can see that there are relatively few of the formal healthcare providers that we would be thinking of. Lots of substance abuse, case managers, community outreach workers, because of the extensive reach into these non-traditional healthcare type sectors. This is Klein enrollment, which has now been completed. And out of 4,645 approached, 95% agreed to be screened. That is a remarkable number, and I think a tribute to the community engagement and the power that the community leaders and agencies had through these processes. And of the those who were eligible, 93% agreed to enroll in the study. However, some of them were inaccessible. They were either in prison, they'd given up their cell phone, and so forth, for baseline. We're recovering some of them. We ended up with 899 enrolled participants who completed their full baseline assessment. The study was designed to have 700. We ended up with 900. Participants, because of the efficiency, once we got going with this 9-month delay to complete the design and the engagement with all of this input, then things went much faster and more efficiently than we thought. And it's pretty balanced by participants. And this is the distribution of, this is the screening rate for depression by sector. So you can see, as expect, well, these are very high rates. This is the economy right now, I believe. In primary care, 35%. You normally expect about 12, 15, something like that. So all of these, mental health, I think you'd expect close to 50%. Homeless services, social services, 20%. Substance abuse, 35%. So this is these are pretty high numbers, 29% overall. About not quite 60% female, somewhat more male than expected because of the substance abuse agencies. 74% with a family income under $10,000 a year. So this is a very impoverished group. 28% unemployed but in the workforce. 59% unemployed and not in the workforce. 57% report being in poor or fair general health, only 3.5% excellent. This is just a little collective efficacy item that was included in the survey. And then just to close, since we have 1 minute, and many of you probably have to leave already, I just wonder if, you know, since we talked about capacity building, we've given a lot of thought to what is the community gaining from this study. And I think Jim and Felika, and I'll just show you these two slides, you know, the trainings, the CEUs, we've made a lot of effort to do agency dollar matching requirements to clarify that for agencies so they can apply for funding, letters of support for their grants, sustainable websites, and so forth. But if Felika and Jim, if I could just invite you to comment on this process of both making the study helpful to the community and clarifying that with the community.
I think the most important one is the hope that, that we brought to the community, because this all kind of developed around a very demoralizing time, I think, for providers. And this came in and said, look, there is something we can do. We can do it together if we work together. And it's not just this issue, but the whole concept of if we work together, we can probably have some impact on what's going on in our community. And I think that that was really important in terms of community benefits. It did a lot to get people to understand research and how important research is into getting services into the community. I don't think a lot of folks really understood that, you know, if there's no data out there, then nobody's going to give you any money because nobody knows what's going on. So being a part of this gives you an opportunity to say where you are, what's going on. And again, then just the, some of the services that we're bringing in is expanding the capacity in the community, because it is very limited, especially in the SPA 6 area.
And another key point was, you know, to be able to offer the CME CEUs for a lot of the agencies and time off of work, it was a developmental growth for staff that they really appreciated that for some of our trainings, like our, you know, when we did our CEP workshops and trainings on CPT, they were able to get, you know, credit for that as well. You know, so that was an immediate give back to the community as a partner. So, you know, I think they covered most of it. And I know the time is limited, but, you know, letters of support and be able to help support them in their writing or looking at their evaluation piece of their grant that they're writing for, the, what we've done in our research helped to really clarify and help these agencies know how to support and look at the importance of evaluation within the projects that they're trying to submit for. So it was a benefit for them, and it was they really valued those.
So we're currently in the active intervention year. We've done the capacity building. What the community has now decided to do after directing the capacity building is to get services to the study clients to there's so many barriers, it's unbelievable the barriers in the community to getting services or to collaborating across agencies. So they've come up with this incredibly creative idea called the Village Clinic, where some resources from the study are going to fund providers to provide free services to clients who've not been able to get services across these agencies for a limited period of time. So at least there can be a chance, and we're working out the MOUs and so forth, so that agencies, a given agency, can take clients from any other agency, provided that those clients are willing to go there for free.
And these are clients that are, they, like Ken has said, these are clients that are not on Medi-Cal, that don't have access to services, the ones that are falling through the gaps. Those are the clients that these agencies hopefully will be able to work through and be able to funnel into where, you know, DMH can't take them, or so, you know, the other agencies cannot afford to take these people. They're still need of services, and that was one of the one of the concerns of the community when we did the screening and we started looking at some of the numbers that were coming from the screenings, that we still ethically have to offer them something. That would, you know, we need to find some kind of resource for them. And that was one of the things that they came up that we could, you know, so out of those workshops and some of the, you know, things that we're going to have the resiliency piece where they'll come, you know, for a series of classes and they can get, you know, some behavior activation stuff, and then there'll be some light case management to help them navigate through some general services that they have through the agencies of the community village.
And I think
CP Village.
A longer term benefit is that with the, you know, academicians tracking this whole process, it does, as I said before, give some data to support doing something like this, and perhaps future funding might go into this kind of an area where, you know, programs that are willing to work together can reach a much broader audience than what's
being done. We are
now
dashing to try to get this done while the surveys are still being done. I mean, right? So we're already halfway through 6-month outcome surveys. So we've got like 6 months to try to get all these clients into these services. I mean, it's still nice to help them anyway, but we'd like to be able to show in the research, and the community would like to also be able to show that it makes a difference. So we've had like 6 weeks between the idea coming up and trying to implement these agreements and get the money rerouted to start that services process. But I think we're going to get there.
I agree. Very helpful.
So.
Really impressive project. Congratulations, everybody.
Thank you.
Yes.
What's the total budget for the whole project?
Well, that's a good question. So I think, believe it or not, the original study was funded with the traditional $500,000 direct cap per year it's an NIMH study. So we had $2.5 million direct for 5 years. We then got an ERA supplement of about $1 million to allow us to expand the study to track employment outcomes, because the Obama administration became very interested in the study and what it might offer for a way of helping the economy, you know, through healthcare. So that money is now over. But that also allowed us to add an additional year onto the study. So it's going to be a 6-year study, and we've carefully, we had to add almost an entire extra year for all this planning because of all this. We had to redirect the entire study. I mean, you can tell from the extensive redesign that was done, and to get the community buy-in. So it took almost 2 years of planning to do this study. But then, as I mentioned, what happened is the actual engagement and recruitment happened in 6 months. All those clients, we thought it would take us a year and a half, it took us 6 months. Once the buy-in was there, we ran the study like that, we caught up on our budget, caught up on our time frame. It's been really amazing as an example of how the community engagement is worth the additional time for, you know, this sample, I don't know if you noticed it, but it's 89% African American or Latino. I don't know many NIH studies like that, with 900 minority subjects in a randomized trial. So, anyway.
Yeah, two quick questions. One is also really exciting stuff. One is a follow-up on the budget question.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you're starting out with a 500 a year and over 5 years. And one of the challenges, at least in my experience, is often when you're working with community-based agencies or nonprofits, of sort of how the heck do you sort of allocate stuff? You've got a higher overhead sometimes for the academics, and
yes,
you have very talented people in the community,
yes,
and they need some staffing funds. So
yes,
that would be one question. The other is also, or is more related to, I'm just wondering if you at any point got any pushback from sort of the traditional providers of having the non-traditional providers doing some of these intervention services.
Yeah, all of those are great points. So in relationship to the budget, we do have, you know, in the CPPR model a formula, which is a third, a third, a third. A third for community, a third for academics, a third for the combined resource of the intervention and the data. We are probably, you know, the academic side is probably more than its share, somewhat, not grossly, in this study, just because it is such a difficult study to put up and manage. It was, now it's become easier. We have subcontracts to, they're not large. Healthy African American Families has the most substantial. We have the two other lead community agencies have smallish subcontracts. That's part of what the ERA funding helped us with. And then we have consulting fees. And then we put a budget into the councils, which people have never had discretionary budgets before. So all of those things are viewed as either resources in kind or actual resources in the community. My budget staff and operations staff, because I have a center, which I didn't talk about, it's a partnered research center. Our entire staff are used to this model. We have many projects under this model. This is the largest one. So they know about this. They know how to construct the budget. They will catch me if I'm asking for too much on the academic side. And then because we have the center, we have ways of helping the study out, and it helps the center, a product here and there, a pilot study. We got a couple of diversity supplements on the study that helped as well. So, and then as far as the pushback from traditional providers, first of all, the mental health providers love this study because they get all the CBT training. Everybody loves CBT. We've had a very difficult time engaging primary MDs, basically. They don't have the time in the public sector. They don't want the responsibility. They're worried they'll be stuck with the dollar without the funding at this point. We do have some, but it has been very difficult. So in primary care, they wanted us to use their case managers pretty much and leave the docs alone. It's totally different from Partners in Care, which was all physician-based. We just don't see the buy-in. And it actually causes me a lot of concern about the whole medical home concept for these kinds of patients. I don't know where the training and experience is going to come from. It's not from the public sector primary care providers, except in some spots. So I think the pushback has typically been, so for example, we have a minority graduate student getting his doctoral dissertation on the case management aspect of the study. He presented the model that he helped us develop for case management and in community settings. And his advisor and all of the doctoral students were very upset, just for the reason you mentioned. What makes you think that a non-licensed provider, even with supervision, but there's no choice. The question is, who's going to get anything? And
I think the other half of that too is that a number of the traditional providers are so overwhelmed that any kind of help at all is like, oh great.
They're so overwhelmed. I mean, we are, one of the things is because we have such an extremely disadvantaged population, there's a suicide item in the survey. So the clinicians who are directing the study have to take call for every suicidal patient. We have done 170 interventions by telephone just to field the surveys. And as an example, last night I was talking to a woman in South Los Angeles who was brought by a mother on a 5150 to an emergency, the police came, brought to an emergency room, held for 24 hours, sent home, no referral. She has nowhere to go. Because she was in the study, I called her. So she's saying, what do I do? So I'm giving her the referrals, giving her names, giving her phone numbers. She gets a suicide hotline number. What would happen to this woman? Just the experience of the other issue is the experience of doing the study. The community partners are used to this. What they're not used to is, that some study psychiatrist is going to call their patient to help them. But that's part of why we think there's just not enough capacity out there. So if it's going to be an alternative workforce, what I'm worried about is how can we convince someone that they need to be reimbursed. So I'm actually testifying on Thursday. I'm the only mental health person testifying to the IOM Essential Health Benefits Committee on what should be essential health benefits for mental health. And am I going to give yeah, a story.
The one perspective I have, the physicians, the medical physicians who are struggling in this environment, they know that a lot of the problems they're struggling with are psychosocial problems and substance abuse that aren't being discovered, and the amount of resources that are wasted because we don't recognize and treat these issues is huge.
Amen.
Their time, their effort, and also from a payer perspective, someone's paying for the care, they're paying for the ERs, they're paying for all the inappropriate stuff. If the integrated approach could be brought into the front line of medical care so the psychosocial issues were recognized before all the costs were incurred, then I think that might be a way to at least the first tack on how to tackle this in a medical environment.
Yeah, as Jim was pointing out when we were preparing before we started talking, one of the challenges is a lot of what would be needed is outside the scope of medicine. Housing, social support, intervention with life stress events. I think you can medicalize them, and that's part of the reason that caseworkers might be particularly critical, because they have those skills, and maybe that's mainly what they do. So, you know, if this were hypertension, you know, it wouldn't play out quite the same way, because the illness itself, I mean, yes, it's a result of the environment, but people kind of recognize that. For mental health, we have this whole other mindset, and we don't understand how things are connected,
right,
and the models of care that we need. You can tell I'm preparing my testimony. in order to have people recover and have good outcomes or avoid problems to begin with.
Right.
So we have these crazy-making policies and distinctions that we make, and it just does not fit the illnesses at, you know, at the table.
Right.
So that's what I'm hoping we could try to help policymakers change, including through some data from this study.
So that's why I'm so surprised that you had 90% success before in the data you showed us on recovery at 5 years from depression. You know, how
what do you mean 90% success?
In African Americans, yeah,
oh,
on that.
Oh, okay. Well, okay. So some of that, yes.
Yeah.
All right. But look at what they were like without the intervention. So the reason, I believe, is that's a selection effect. So basically, in the world today, if you're white and you're treatment responsive, you probably, you know, you're out. You're not even getting screened in a study like this. So what's left are highly treatment responsive people who've never had anything. So the African Americans were untouched. It's just like low-hanging fruit. I think they never had anything. You see what I'm saying? So there's, and that's also a very good message. So that, I mean, actually, when Partners in Care was funded, we were asked not to include minorities in the study, because there were only 6 known minorities in any randomized trial of treatment for depression at the time that study was funded. And we said there's no reason to assume that minorities are going to be less responsive. And it turns out they're highly responsive. They just never been treated.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it's not like we assign treatment to them.
Mm-hmm.
We just help their practices have the resources and did some patient activation.
Mm-hmm.
And people got that much better.
And those are largely disadvantaged setting care delivery.
Well, in Partners in Care, it was private sector managed care and one Medicaid site. So these are actually, in Partners in Care, those were mainly private sector patients. And even so, there was that huge disparity in getting care. And then what happened is, when people had a fair chance at getting treatment, then you equalized the outcome. I mean, no surprise,
yeah.
But we just don't do it. You know, so that's what kind of drove me crazy. And it was like, okay, so what are we going to do?
So maybe one last question. Can listen away when I ask this is, sounds like you've really built something that was like taking a field and taking the stones away, creating an infrastructure. Is it sustainable when and if he goes away?
Mm-hmm.
Do you think this will survive? And is there interest into continuing this in the community? Would you welcome other opportunities for collaboration of this nature for other disease outcomes?
Yeah, I believe that is a true statement, that they are interested and it is a sustainable model, that the people that are at the table are very much taking a leadership role in developing something that stays in the community over time. And so they have actually really, to network between one another, to the idea of like this the village, which we have a web center that, you know, kind of they talk on, and we're trying to really make sure that piece is really, they want to make sure that piece is like really set in place, and how do we, you know, continue to this collaboration afterwards. But I think that everybody at the table, that was one of the biggest things in our planning piece, that they kept, you know, emphasizing, I want it to last after they're gone. So, and I think that is one of the commitments. And Jim, you could kind of...
Well, I was just going to say that this is kind of a new concept for a lot of folks. Historically, the agencies that we kind of talk about are very much turf-oriented, and it's always been a
funding
struggle. You know, I got to get as much money as I can because you're going to get your money. And this concept really shows how we can work together, pool our resources,
and get money to
because support. I pointed out before, there may be folks in this who are really good at housing. Mm-hmm. There are other folks who are good at, you know, primary care, medical services, other folks that are good at some kind of behavioral health care. All of us working together can make things much better. Now, to what extent, that's, I think there's still going to be help needed from, you know, the powers that be that grant funding to places. But I think in this day and age, we'll go a lot better to say, look, this is how we can reach a larger number of people for fewer dollars than kind of the way we've been doing.
And I think that another way to look at it, and I think the way that the community partners that are looking at it is that if we can link how outcomes make a difference, if we have these other partnerships at the table, then it could definitely develop more resources and stuff for the community as a whole and for the people that they were trying to serve. Because if I'm a workforce investment person and I have a grant to, you know, train 100 people over this period of time, but I can't get them activated, I can't get them to follow through with the job searches or whatever, if I can show that I, you know, this person maybe have been some depression or whatever, and I have a partnership with Jim, with substance abuse or whatever, then I can then, you know, develop an infrastructure in my budget to have Jim's behavioral health services be a subcontract or whatever into my budget when we're writing for something. And I can show through what I've learned through the evaluation pieces and stuff that I can sustain this over time. So, and I think that our partnerships have learned a lot about how the support of a collaborative group makes a difference between doing it in a silo.
Then it sounds like you've been a tremendous success regardless of what happens next year. Thank you so much for coming and sharing that with us. That's great.
Thank you.